So the way I'll present the outline of the talk is that I'll go through the title one word at a time. So basically, I'll start the talk with talking a little bit about what computational models mean, mainly focusing on game-based model. Then yesterday, we had a lot of talks about PretaVota, so probably I'll just go briefly on what's important for this talk from PretaVota. So just summarizing what we already spoke about yesterday. And receipt freeness as a concept, probably familiar to a lot of you here, but I'll be trying to define it in a game-based model so that we could use it in proving the PretaVota receipt-free in a game-based model. So taking what exists in literature and trying to present it in a language that we could use for computational models. Then, as much as time permits, we could go through the proving bit, which I'll be talking about an instantiation of PretaVota, which really is the main difference is with how the ballots are generated in that. And we'll go through a briefing of the proof. So we'll start with computational security models and game-based models. Basically, a voting scheme, in our case, PretaVota, is as secure, and by secure I mean privacy more than integrity or verifiability, but is as secure as the encryption scheme used. And in the encryption scheme used, when we're talking PretaVota, we really mean the onion and the right-hand side. So this is a statement that what my comment on it is that an encryption scheme can have different levels of security. So in a computational model, the model you use for an encryption scheme could differ, and the strength of that encryption scheme differs according to that model. Then there is some kind of reduction to a complexity assumption. Again, the complexity assumption differs and from one scheme to another. And then what size of keys and what security parameter you choose also affects what type of how secure the encryption scheme is. So basically, the word secure as the encryption scheme is what we're trying to study when we decide to go through computational model analysis. And yeah, so the question is, how secure does the encryption scheme need to be in order for us to have a receipt-free property? And our case study is PretaVota. So that's what the whole idea of using computational model, the motivation behind using computational models. So I'll go through a general kind of explanation of what it means to prove something under a game-based model. And basically, like any security analysis, you have, of course, the cryptographic scheme, what it does, the functionalities, and so on. And then you have a security notion, what it means for a cryptographic scheme to be secure. Then you have a sample construction of that cryptographic scheme. And finally, you try seeing, according to your definition of security, does that construction meet it? And that's what we mean by proving it secure. So what do we mean by defining a security notion? So basically, in game-based model, you're assuming an adversary and a challenger. Adversary is playing the bad guy, of course, given the name. It's playing the bad guy, and it's given certain powers. The challenger is playing the honest entities in the system. And what you need to define is how much power you give that adversary, so what access, what information that adversary has. And you need to define what it means to win the game. And what it means to win a game actually implies what it means to break the system, so they come together. So if the adversary, after interacting with a challenger, manages to win the game, then the system is broken. So that's a description of the high level of what a game model means. So what does it mean to use it in proving security? I'll just give a recipe here, and you'll see it in proving PretaVota in a more clear way. But the recipe is you have a mathematical problem. Could be either given an input, compute an output, or given an input, can you decide whether it's A or B or some mathematical known problem. You know it's hard in a certain setting. You assume the adversary of the exists in that setting, and you assume that that adversary can always win the game. And the idea is showing that if that adversary exists in that setting and wins the game, then that means the mathematical problem is solved. Given we know that mathematical problem is hard to be solved, then that adversary cannot be exist. So that's generally the recipe, if you want, of proving a system under a game model secure. An example of that, for instance, is in an encryption scheme. This is what I mean by a cryptographic scheme. You have several, in literature, you have several notations in distinguishability of ciphertext. That's the game models for security notion. You have different constructions to implement an encryption scheme. And you have different complexity assumptions that manage to compare a certain construction to a certain game model and reduce it to a mathematical problem. So among this, the reason why I gave an encryption scheme is we really, in Preta Vote, we will be using an encryption scheme to guarantee privacy of the vote. So we will be comparing the receipt freeness property to one of those indistinguishability games. So which one it is? It's a ciphertext, a modified version of the ciphertext chosen attack. So the idea is, again, the adversary and the challenger. The challenger sets the system. He creates the public key and the secret key. The adversary should have access to the public key. Everyone has access to the public key, so that's given to him. The secret key is kept secret to the challenger, because if the challenger has a secret key, then the system is broken anyway. It's trivially broken. The power you give the adversary in this case is a decryption oracle. What it means is the adversary could decrypt, send a cipher, and get the message back from the challenger. And the idea of the game is mainly here. This is what we mean by defining what it means, what the challenge is. So this basically says an attacker, the adversary chooses the two messages that he wants to challenge. He sends it to the challenger. The challenger encrypts them and permutes them, sends them back to the adversary. So either he sends the first message encrypted and then the second one, or vice versa. And the idea is the adversary has to guess the order. He has to know whether it's E0 send or E1, whether the first cipher is for M0 or for M1, and the same for the second cipher. If the adversary manages to guess that, it's an indication that the adversary, even though he doesn't have a secret key, can actually reduce some information from the ciphertext. And you give, after the challenge, you give access to more of the decryption oracle, except that if you decrypt the main challenged elements, you solve the problem as an adversary, so they're restricted. And yeah, at the end, the adversary has to guess which order he received. Of course, he has a 50-50 chance. The idea is to try to reduce it to say that he doesn't have an advantage more than the 50-50 chance of guessing. So Preta Vote, if the system we're talking about is Preta Vote, that's what we put in the cryptographic scheme. We're gonna try defining receipt freeness, which is the security notion we're concerned in. The construction of the scheme is gonna be using something called Noor-Young transformation, which I'll explain in a minute. And we're gonna be reducing it to that game model of indistinguishability of encryption. So that's the security proof we'll have. Yeah?
On the previous slide, you had CCA, and here you've got CCA2. Is it CCA2 that you have in mind?
CCA2 with the modification. This is a typo. So basically, it's the difference. CCA2 is we return one message, and you have to guess which one it is. This one has a vector of messages, and you guess the order of it. So, yeah, it's definitely CCA2. We have the decryption oracle before and after. Yeah? So that's what we're trying to reduce the receipt freeness to, the indistinguishability of the encryption, which really means we're trying to compare the receipt freeness to the strength of the encryption scheme. So among the things here, the system of Pretta-Vota has been studied and exists before, so it's not really what we're proposing. The receipt freeness does exist before as a definition. It actually probably had also different iterations and so on, different strengths of definitions. But basically, we need to define it in a way that we could use it in a computational model. So we need to reflect what exists in literature in the language of computational model, which is a game-based in our case. So that's why this paper proposes a new game-based definition for receipt freeness. The construction, again, the reason why I have a question mark and a tick is that construction exists. We know how to build a Pretta-Vota system. The only thing is that we did need to modify the way we do the ballot slightly in order to be able to prove it. And that modification uses Noor-Yong transformation, which, again, I'll explain in a minute. And yes, we had to reduce it, basically. We had to prove that it could be reduced to the indistinguishability of ciphertext. So Pretta-Vota, that's the bit where we had two talks about yesterday, so I'll probably go through it quickly, but there is one abstract description that I'll highlight, because this is the description that we'll be using in our work. So going back to the title, that's the second part, Pretta-Vota. This is the abstract description. So basically what this says is you have an election authorities producing ballots, and those ballots in a confidential way reach the voters. The details of how that happens don't matter for our proof, but you could assume, well, there are assumptions of that the post is a way of doing it, but in any case, what we care about in our abstraction is somehow it reaches to the voter in a confidential way. Probably one of the things mentioned yesterday is print on demand. That also helps in that. The voter is the second entity. So you have the election authority, which generates the ballot. You have the voter. The voter receives that ballot and goes to this booth. And it's assumed, again, what happens in the booth, it happens in a confidential way. So he gives, you could imagine it as he receives a ballot with the left-hand side, ticks his vote, and in return, he goes out of the booth with some receipt, so which is the right-hand side. So, and this bit is done in a confidential, private way. Now, in the booth, he also has the ability to either audit or vote. And those again, they happen in the booth. He receives, it was, as explained yesterday, he gives out the right-hand side and receives the candidate order in return, and it's marked on the bulletin board as audited, so you can't use it. And he gives, if he decides to vote, he gives his vote to the bulletin board, and somehow there is some authorities calculated in tally and publishing the final result. So, yeah, this is probably was explained several times yesterday, but I'll go briefly through it. It's again the randomized list of candidates, some kind of encryption. You tick a box to the vote you like. You separate them. You shred this part. This all happens in the booth, assumed, of course, that it's private and confidential area. No one sees what you're doing. And you leave with this bit, which is the receipt. And again, auditing was mentioned yesterday. You ask, you separate them, you ask for the decryption, and you get back the left-hand side. So you could compare if it's well-formed ballot. Tallying is, the tallying authorities, whether it's a set of trustees, receive at the end the onions, and from that they reconstruct the ballot and could tell the vote and could calculate the tallying. The thing that most all Pareto voter systems rely on is how to mix, how to decrypt, and how to tally, and that could either use mixed nets or homomorphic tallying. It differs from one variant of Pareto voter to the other, but it's the whole idea is to move from a set of encrypted votes to a set of unencrypted votes in a way that no one could link the vote to the voter. Okay, so basically what are the assumptions we're doing? It's mainly three assumptions. The first one is saying that all ballots have a serial number, probably the hash of the onion, to identify it, and that means no ballots have the same onion and no two ballots have the same onion or the same serial number, so uniqueness of ballots. The second assumption we have is, we listed in the paper as a set of assumptions, but mainly it implies that the left-hand side of the ballot is never revealed throughout the process. So if you start assuming that there is a camera or the voter left in the booth or the voter left with the ballot, then the whole proving the system secure, you have the plain text. So it makes no sense. So we're assuming that the adversary has no access in the left-hand side of the ballot, and there are means proposed in literature on how we could do that. This is just a list of it, just saying things like the booth is private, the auditing, if you audit, then you cannot use the same ballot to vote, and so on. So basically that list of assumptions really mean that the left-hand side is not revealed to the adversary. And the last assumption we have is that the tabulation reveals the final tally information. So, those are the three assumptions we require in our proof. So what does receipt freeness mean in this case, in our scenario, in Pareto voter and in a game-based model? So first of all, we list down a list of oracles, which is what capabilities do we give the adversary should not trivially break the system. They could cause other attacks, but we don't care about other attacks in this case. We care only about receipt freeness. So the oracles we give is, the first one is retrieving empty ballots. The adversary could ask for a set of ballots he wants. He could keep asking for more ballots. And that means he sees both right-hand and left-hand side. Reveal candidate order. That means that the adversary could give the right-hand side and ask for the left-hand side to be revealed, and the challenger should be able to give him the right-hand side. Then a vote is giving the adversary the chance to actually add votes to the election, and that implies votes on ballots that he produced or votes on ballots that the challenger produced. So how the ballot was generated doesn't matter, but he could actually submit a vote, and he could ask for the tally at any certain point and get the result back. Now, if you look at that set of oracles, they're too powerful for the adversary. Like, you have things, when the adversary could vote, you have things that could express things like ballot stuffing and so on. And revealing candidate order, that's already revealing the onion of the receipt and so on. So the idea here is, besides having the adversary vote, you're affecting the election. So the idea here is not all those attacks. We're giving the adversary as much as he wants attacks, but we're worried about one thing, and that's receipt freeness. So to present the oracles, just to link it to the system, so basically, retrieve empty ballot is presenting this part of the system. Voting represents that part of the system. Reveal candidate order presents this part of the system. And then this is for the reveal bulletin board. So yeah. So now the game. The game basically starts with the challenger setting up the system, deciding on the security parameters, how to build the system, and so on. But one of the things he said is a bulletin board, which is read-only for the adversary, and the challenger could fill it up as much as he wants, but the adversary could have a, he could read it. He has access to read it. After setting up the system, the adversary has the chances to query all those oracles we propose, so he could get empty ballots, he could reveal candidate order, reveal bulletin board, and vote. And point where you capture receipt freeness is mainly in the challenge. So what happens is the challenger gives the adversary two receipts, I and J. The condition of I and J are the serial numbers of the receipts. So the condition of I and J is one is a vote for Alice and the other one is a vote for Bob, randomly assigned. The ballots are generated by the challenger. So if the adversary created those receipts, then he could definitely know which one is for Alice and which one is for Bob. So they have to be honestly generated from the challenger. And again, as two receipts, they could not be queried into those oracles that reveal the information for the adversary. So for instance, if I and J are queried in the candidate order, then the adversary already knows the candidate order and he could easily distinguish between I and J. And same for voting. If he could vote with one of them, the votes Alice and Bob have to be decided by the challenger. If the adversary is the one to decide, then he could tell which one is which. And yeah, he could not have received the left-hand side of it, so he could not have queried it in the empty ballot bit. So basically those constraints that we put on the I and J is saying that there is no information about just those two receipts that will make the adversary solving the problem, it wouldn't make the solving the problem of the adversary trivial. And we give more chances for the adversary to query the oracles mentioned above, except again the constraints we mentioned here are still remain. He's not allowed to query I and J in the vote oracle or the reveal candidate.
Are they distinct necessarily?
What is it?
Are I and J necessarily distinct?
They have to be distinct. They are two valid receipts created by the challenger, and we have the assumption that the serial numbers should not be the same. But yeah, they have to also, as a vote, have to be distinct. I don't know if that's what you meant. So one has to be.
I can imagine two right-hand sides with the same onion but different check marks, and that's not what we're talking about.
No. They have to be two different ciphertexts. So in the list of assumptions, one of the main assumptions we had is every ballot has a different serial number and onion, the uniqueness of a ballot.
But a receipt does include the X as well as the onion.
Yeah. Ah, okay, I see what you mean. It's two receipts, the onions are different, the serial numbers are different. Where the index is put, you'll see in a minute that it makes no difference as long as one of them is a vote for Alice and one of them is a vote for Bob. So if the indexes are in the same place or different places, it shouldn't make a difference as long as because you're giving access to the adversary to retrieve the bulletin board. So he could see that one went for Alice and one went for Bob. That's what matters. So I don't know if that answered.
I think so.
Yeah, OK. And finally, for the adversary to win, he needs to guess which of those I and J were used as a vote for Alice and which one was used for a vote for Bob. Of course, he has the 50-50 chance of guessing it right. So if this is the game-based model, but the definition of winning is if the adversary guesses correctly, then he wins. And basically what we're saying is that there's this 50-50 chance, the chance of winning minus that 50-50 guess, the probability of 50-50, should be negligible. So there should be no advantage other than the normal probability of guessing. Okay, so that's the game-based model. I'll probably revisit it shortly to when we come to the proof. But before we reach that, the thing we needed is we had to introduce this, modify the ballot generation to include a Noor-Yonge transformation, which I kept saying I'll explain in a minute. What does that mean? Basically, what happened while we're trying to prove the system secure, the challenge we face, is that most of the time you're using homomorphic encryption, whether for the mixnets, whether for the tallying, but a lot of times you use homomorphic encryption for generating the onions, which are malleable and they are CPA. And when we came to proving the system secure, we needed the decryption oracle, which means we cannot use such encryption schemes. And we needed ballots that are created in a CCA2 model. And yet we don't want to get rid of the homomorphic properties if we need them. If they're needed in the system, you don't want to get rid of them. So how do we find a way to get both properties, it being homomorphic and CCA2? And basically, a paper, I think early 90s actually, Noor-Yonge came up with this conversion of changing any CPA system into a CCA system. Sahib said that, well, actually, the way you're doing it makes it CCA2. And we, to fit the format of Pret-a-Voter, we proposed the CCA2 plus, which in the paper we show that it's equivalent to CCA2. So basically, we're saying if we use a Noor-Yonge transformation, then we keep the CPA property to parts of it, but we add zero knowledge proofs in order to guarantee non-malleability. So the overall of the ballot is non-malleable, yet parts of the onion could be used with their homomorphic property. Yeah? Okay, so how does that work? Basically, to build a Noor-Yonge transformation, you need two building blocks. You need an encryption scheme that is CPA, which means you have an encryption, decryption, and a key generation. And you need a proof that says, if I have an encryption with one public key and an encryption with another public key of the same message, I'm proving that the message is the same. So this zero knowledge proof is what gets rid of the malleability property. And what happens in a Noor-Yonge transformation is to generate the keys, you generate twice different keys, the different key pairs, PK1 and PK2, and SK1 and SK2. The two secret keys become the secret key of the Noor-Yonge. The two public keys become the public keys of Noor-Yonge. And when you need to encrypt, you don't just encrypt the message, you encrypt the message twice, once in this public key and once in that public key, and you give a zero knowledge proof that the message is the same. So still C1 and C2 probably could be malleable as individual elements, but as an overall, when you're giving cipher 1 and cipher 2 and the zero knowledge proof, they're not malleable because to create the zero knowledge proof, you need the randomization factors chosen for both of them. So you're saying you get rid of the malleability by that, while C1 and C2 could still, as individual bits, be homomorphic and malleable. So now the ciphertext is all three parts. And the decryption is first verify the zero knowledge. You're checking that no one changed anything. And then decrypt either C1 or C2, doesn't matter, but decrypt one of the elements. So that's the Noor-Yonge transformation. Okay, so what happens is now we need to build the ballot using that transformation. So the ballot generator now doesn't have one pair of keys, he has two pairs of keys. And what he does is he creates the list of candidate ciphertexts as with this format, which is the Noor-Yonge format, where C1 is with one public key, C1 prime is with another public key, M is the candidate code or name. And what happens is that you give also pi saying that those two pairs have the same candidate, those two pairs have the same candidate. And that would be the format of the ballot. It will have a list of, for each candidate, two ciphertexts and a zero knowledge proof. Now to randomize though, what we, well, it was there in previous work of Retavota, we just reused the same idea, is we randomize this list. So it's a list, the list of candidates encrypted with randomization one, which means everyone could verify that all candidates exist on that list. And then you put it in a verifiable shuffle. And you give Pi to be the proof of the verifiable shuffle. So you know that this list, C1 to CK, is the list of candidates because you could verify the input, just shuffled. Yeah? And then the onion becomes all Noryon transformation with a list of shuffle for them. Yeah? Is there any questions? Is it clear?
What's the proof of the shuffle? The proof of the shuffle is different than the previous model?
Yeah, so the proof of Noryon says that the two pairs have the same message. The proof of the shuffle is you enter the list of candidates encrypted with one into a verifiable shuffle, and the verifiable shuffle gives you a zero knowledge proof that we shuffled that list of ciphertexts they were permuted in an honest way. So it's another zero knowledge proof saying that they were permuted. So, yeah. So this zero knowledge proof is per candidate. This zero knowledge proof is per ballot. Okay. So reducing the system, I don't know if there's more questions before we go into the proof. Yeah? So reducing the system to become reducing receipt freeness with this new construction, not entirely new, just the ballot having a Noryon transformation to INDCCA2. Actually, what we do is we assume there is an existing adversary that could break receipt freeness. So that adversary is assumed that it exists. And what we show is if that adversary exists, and if we use Noryon transformation, then that some simulator could use that adversary to break the CCA2 of Noryon. So this is the game model we earlier explained. So basically what that means is somehow that simulator that will be trying to solve the CCA2 will need to simulate this game model. So he will need to simulate the setup, he will need to simulate the phase one, which is all oracles. He will need to create a challenge which looks reasonable to the adversary, and so on, and he will do that using the input of the CCA2 game model. So the simulator is actually playing a good and a bad guy. So you have the adversary who's breaking the receipt freeness, and we assume that that exists. And that simulator is playing the challenger towards that adversary. So it's playing the challenger in the receipt freeness game model. Except what he's trying to do is whatever input he gets from here, he's going to use as an attacker to the CCA2 model. So that's the whole idea. And if this exists, then we show that this simulator could solve this problem. So basically what we're saying is that in the CCA2, you have to set up a Noryon encryption as a setup phase. We use the public parameters received from to create a setup for Pretavota, and we send public parameters to the adversary. Then we run the oracles here that mentioned for Pretavota, but every now and then we might need the decryption oracle that CCA2 offers, which is sending a cipher and getting in return a message. And we use that oracle to be able to respond to certain elements of these oracles. So whenever the adversary requests something, we could respond using the decryption oracle sometimes, and sometimes you could respond on your own. I'll go into the details soon. Then you have to simulate the challenge, which is you have to create two receipts that look valid to the adversary, and But and you use the challenge here. You send the messages to the challenger. You get a ciphertext, and you use that in creating the receipts. And that way, when you're simulating the challenge, what happens is in the guess, whatever guess the adversary guesses here should help you in guessing the values here, which means that if the adversary exists and could guess right, then this simulator should be able to guess right too. Yeah? So that's a high-level description. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into one row at a time. So I'm opening the boxes. So the setup phase, what happens is you set up Nor Young in the challenger phase. You get the public key of the encryption. And you initialize a bulletin board, which is at the beginning empty because there is no vote submitted, and some database, which is private to you, which it's mainly used for the decryption oracle. So every time I query the decryption oracle, if the same query is needed again, I first check the database and then decide whether I need to query the decryption oracle or not. So this database is private to the simulator, just to keep track of data. And this bulletin board is read-only to the adversary, as defined in the game model. And the Nor Young public key is the same as the parameters of Preta Vota. If you have the public keys of Preta Vota encryption scheme, then you could create ballots too. Now this is phase one and phase two. They're very similar except with the constraints. But what happens is we're going to, probably this is not that clear in the font, but what happens is we're going to simulate the empty ballot oracle, the vote oracle, the candidate order oracle, and the bulletin board, reveal bulletin board oracle. And the general idea here is that every time I get a query for these elements for a ballot generated by the simulator, he has the public keys, so he could generate ballots. Every time the simulator generated that ballot, he could respond immediately to those oracles. He knows what the left-hand side is, so he could respond by adding a vote or revealing the order or giving the whole ballot. So it's as long as the simulator is, it's a ballot the simulator created, then he could respond immediately. He knows the details of it. And in those same oracles, if it's a ballot which the adversary has created, because he has the public keys too, so he has the same powers. So if he created the ballot, he will send it requesting, for instance, to vote. And what happens is, checking the database, the simulator will get to know, okay, it's not one of the ballots I created, therefore I need to send it to the decryption oracle, get the values of it, and respond accordingly. So that's why we need a decryption oracle. That gives us the opportunity to allow the adversary, if he wants to use his corrupted ballots. Yeah? So that's the general idea. Every time you query the decryption oracle, something is added to the database in case the same ballot is queried again. Yeah? Probably that's the most interesting part of the proof, because that's where we define what it means to win the game. And what happens is when the adversary says, I want to challenge, then the simulator chooses the messages he wants to challenge in the CCA2 to be the codes for Alice and Bob. So he says, I want to encrypt those two messages. And he receives a ciphertext of one of the messages, well, two of the messages encrypted. And the idea here is once he receives C, he creates a C prime by himself with the order being Bob and Alice. He knows C prime totally because he created it. And he sends C and C prime as, so he ticks on the receipts and he sends them to the adversary. Now, the thing is, he doesn't know whether the C ballot he receives from the challenger, he doesn't know whether it's a vote for Alice or Bob, but he knows that the second one is a vote for Alice and Bob. And that means the receipts could be faithful, or one of them could be fake. But if they're faithful, then they're indistinguishable from a real receipt of preta vota. So assuming that, the adversary will give a guess, and then the simulator gets some intuition that it is faithful and sends the guess to be, okay, it has to be the order of Alice and Bob, because that's the one which gives the faithful simulation. Now, if it's not faithful, we have to calculate the probability of responding. And to do that, what we do is the receipts are sent, so we assume that the index, the first index is always is the one that is ticked, which means we have at least one vote definitely for Bob. And the idea is you send them randomly the I and J, so you, the simulator knows which one is which, but the adversary doesn't. And if the adversary does not know, he returns a guess. So he returns a 50-50 chance of which receipt is I and which receipt is J. Now, what we do is we calculate the probability. So we calculate the probability that if it was a faithful simulation, will the adversary win, and how much probable that is. And if it was an unfaithful situation, does the adversary win? Well, we're assuming he has to win if it was faithful. So he wins, but what's the probability of the simulator responding to this correctly? Yeah? This is the probability. So alpha, one column presents a faithful simulation, and the other one presents a non-faithful one. And what happens is this one is the unfaithful one. You have the guessing part, the response of the adversary is 50-50 chance because he's just guessing. There is a the winning probability is zero. If it's unfaithful, then you probably will not respond correctly. But if you get the 50 chance of saying it was the previous receipt, the one which the simulator received from the challenger, then it's a 50-50 chance for the challenger too to guess. For the CCA2. Same here, this time it's faithful, so probably it's the probabilities are 50-50 with the advantage of winning the CCA, the advantage epsilon is winning the receipt freeness. So it's 50-50 plus the fact that you can win the receipt freeness. And the chances of winning if it's a faithful simulation is one. You always win because we're assuming the adversary exists. And then we add those probability to each other. Probably the important bit, the details of the probability, probably the important bit is to know that epsilon is the chances of winning with receipt freeness. The addition of all those probabilities causes the epsilon of winning, epsilon prime of winning the CCA2 model to equal epsilon over 4. So if there is a chance of winning, if we're assuming the existence of an adversary who wins the receipt freeness, then there, the simulator has a very strong chance to also, a non-negligible chance to also win the CCA2. So probably this is the most important line, saying that there's strongly linked and the probabilities. If there is an adversary who wins receipt freeness, then that simulator could win CCA2 with high probability. Yeah? So that's the end mainly of the talk. So to conclude, basically, we do need a computational model for analyzing voting schemes. It helps to give an insight of how strong we need the cryptographic system to be. It's probably not on its own the way to go for analyzing, but it's one of the important factors to keep in mind when analyzing a voting scheme. And the second conclusion is to have if you have a CCA2, okay, here I did the typo again, James, but if you have a CCA2 system, which is used in creating the ballots, then that should be sufficient in making sure that the receipt freeness property of preta vota is achieved. So, yeah, thank you very much. And if you have more questions.
quick question.
Yeah.
So the receipt in the proof has the ciphertext of the ordering. But at the beginning of the talk, you said the right-hand side had a hash of the ciphertext.
Both. So basically, the hash is...
The hash I didn't see in the proof anywhere.
Yeah. The hash is, basically what is assumed is the onion is unique, which is the ciphertext.
Yep.
But then for administrative reasons to be able to check your ballot in the bulletin board and so on, usually you have to have a serial number that is easier to find. And
so the ciphertext, anybody can compute the hash, so whether it's there or not doesn't matter. It's computable by anybody, right? So it doesn't add anything. But if you had just the hash, your proof wouldn't apply.
Yeah, you mean adding the hash into the proof?
Well, at the beginning you said that the right-hand side had the hash of the ciphertext, and you didn't say it had the ciphertext as well, so I was...
No, the ciphertext is more important than the hash.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sorry for that. The hash is just mainly for administrative. It's not... So if you have a pret-a-voto with the ciphertext, it will work. The tallyers need the ciphertext.
Yes.
The hash is more just to...
Right. I was imagining some scheme where the hash was on the right-hand side. There was a table of ciphertext somewhere else so that when the receipt was submitted...
No, that was probably misleading. It's No. The ciphertext has to be on the... whether it's on the bulletin board with a link to it or whether it's on the receipt, it doesn't matter, but it has to be accessible to the adversary. The adversary sees it.
I'm trying to understand the game that defines receipt freeness. And so my understanding of receipt freeness would include the possibility that the voter is deliberately trying to produce a receipt and possibly generating their ballot dishonestly because they're trying to build a proof of how they voted.
Yeah.
So where does that appear in your definition?
Okay, so basically, yeah, you're right in that sense, because basically this definition says if the receipts are honestly created, then you should not be able to distinguish between them. By honestly created is, or not corrupted, I mean the left-hand side is not revealed and the randomization factors used in creating that onions are not revealed. Yeah, which means creating a receipt from the adversary in that game model, if the adversary creates the receipt, he's not allowed to challenge it. So he will be able to distinguish it among the bulletin, the elements in the bulletin board. And so from that point of view, it's not captured, it's actually allowed. We give the adversary the keys to create receipts and ballots and to put them on the bulletin board if he wants. And the idea is saying if those two receipts, the challenge is saying if those two receipts have never been seen by the adversary randomization factors or left-hand side, then he shouldn't be able to distinguish. So, yeah, if as an attack, that's still a valid attack. This game model doesn't capture it. Yeah?